Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 8:28 a.m. That is Hong Kong summertime, and today is July 29th. But this is the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes that's generally recorded on a Friday. And this week I thought I would kick off with a look at the VIX index, because there has been such a great deal of commentary relating to it, and not least the outperformance of short VIX ETFs. What we can see over the last 2 years has been that there have been occasional bouts of volatility, but that each successive bout of volatility has been less severe than the last. And that is, there are two ways of looking at it. What that is doing is, from the perspective of people that do not have positions, they're saying, well, that's contributing to the complacency that we have in stock markets. And it is only a matter of time before we get a really big move on the upside. And I think that there is certain truth to that, that this progression of lower rally highs will eventually be broken. And when it is broken, we will have a somewhat larger pullback. But in the meantime, is this still a consistent trend? And of course, what the people with positions, the people who are long, are saying is that this decline in volatility is symptomatic of a much wider and large imbalance between supply and demand, and that is helping to create rather consistent trends right across various different assets. And when we look at, for example, the divergence in performance between the NASDAQ, which is obviously home to some of the largest technology companies. So the NASDAQ got all the way up to 6,000 this week and has paused. And some of the really very large shares within it, for example, Facebook also had its earnings this week, and they were impressive, and the share price really did take off and has actually held the majority of its advance, whereas Amazon, which also had its earnings this week, and said that it is going to be spending more money to achieve those earnings, has pulled back in a rather dynamic manner. But the upward bias remains intact. And when we look at these shares, they are high, they have done very well, but they still continue to hold progressions of higher reaction lows. But they are due some pause and consolidation, and the chances are that is what we're getting. We're getting some pause and consolidation. Apple's earnings will be coming out next week. And I think that this also, you know, considering that it is still the largest company in the world, people are going to be looking at that quite closely. But what we can also say about this chart is that it stopped going up in May, and it has been going sideways since. This looks like a relatively similar reaction to that which we saw back between September and November. In fact, it's almost about the same size as well. That the one between September and November was about $15, and so far so is this one. So then this is what we could consider as a normal reaction within the context of a market that has been trending very powerfully since the beginning of 2016. And it continues to look like a reversionary process. But I did say that we should contrast what's going on in the NASDAQ with what's going on in the Dow Jones. Because the Dow Jones hit a new all-time high in here this week and held it. And that's quite different, isn't it? That looks to me to be an index that is moving to a position of outperformance. So then if we look at that in terms of where are we in terms of the stock market cycle, that if we look at these major indices and ask ourselves, you know, very important questions like, do we see evidence of trend-ending characteristics? That is the most important question we can ask at this stage, because there is a great deal of argument going on right now. And one thing that is certainly worth considering is that a bull market climbs a wall of worry. And there are a lot of people expressing worry about what the potential upside or the potential for markets is. And if people are expressing worry, that tells us more about what their individual positions are rather than what they're likely to do with their money. And when we have the, and you know, for example, Howard Marks this week was, and his bearish note was what was picked up by the media, but I posted it earlier in the week, and it really is worth reading because what he is saying is that I think I might be early. I've been early previously. I've been warning about the bearish connotations of what's going on out there for the last 6 years, and I haven't been right so far. And of course, he will be right eventually. That there will eventually be a bear market. There will eventually be a pullback, and we will have a crash at some point in the future. That just because markets have been going up for a long time does not mean that they will always go up. But even if you consider all those bearish factors, the much broader and much more important question is whether there is going to be a crash now, whether there is going to be a crash within the next week or the next month or the next year. Or then, by and large, the attitude that works best in stock markets is to be bullish, to consider that there are risks out there, that we have to be vigilant to what they are, but as long as we do not have evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend ending characteristics, then the most likely scenario is that a reasonably consistent trend will continue to do what it has been doing. And that is that a consistent trend is a trend in motion. If the consistency characteristics are that it ranges higher, or it ranges and breaks out and ranges and breaks out, then if it continues to do that, then it's a consistent trend and a trend in motion. And as long as we do not have evidence of trend ending characteristics, well, then if we are then deciding to sell or deciding to conclude that the market has indeed ended, well, then we are telling the market what to do. And the most important point is, of course, that the market doesn't listen. Then if we look at these, and I think it is worth, for example, simply clicking through the constituents of the Dow Jones, because what something that I have noticed on a number of occasions over the last couple of years is that, especially for dividend aristocrat type companies, that when we look at, for example, companies like Coca-Cola or McDonald's or Nestle, that their yields tend to get up to around 3.5%, and then they start to rally. So, for example, 3M has now pulled back to the region of the trend mean. American Express has just paused, but then AT&T rallied in an emphatic manner this week. Boeing, we could only consider that this is now accelerating higher. Caterpillar is breaking out to new highs, new 5-year highs at least. Chevron bouncing from the region of the trend mean. Cisco right in the region of the trend mean. Coca-Cola is pressuring its previous peak. DuPont is at a new all-time high. Exxon, and obviously we'll be talking about the oil price, but Exxon is also a company that produces more gas than oil, and this is an area where it really does need to find support. And I think what we can see from all of these shares is that not only is it that old world type companies or dividend aristocrat type companies, the kind of companies that in many respects had been written off over the last couple of years, are beginning to turn around. Whereas there are others that for example, like GE, which have had some serious challenges to their business models and have pulled back really quite abruptly. The banking sector and Goldman Sachs is still trading in the region of the trend mean. Home Depot is in the region of the trend mean. Intel is bouncing from the region of the trend mean. IBM is another one of those companies that has had these challenges to its business model. And it really does, and I think IBM needs to go through a transition before it can really migrate from hardware to software. Johnson and Johnson, it looks like to be it's a reversion to the mean. JP Morgan has been leading the banking sector for really since 2008. And McDonald's, having done spectacularly well, looks like it is due some consolidation. Then Merck is in the region of the trend mean. Microsoft is trending consistently higher. And then Nike has broken this medium-term progression of lower rally highs. Pfizer is in the region of the trend mean. Procter and Gamble is firming from the region of the trend mean. Travelers has been trending higher for years. And UTX is pausing now in the region of a previous peak. And Verizon had a very strong week this week as well. So what we can see is that, and I think Walmart is another great example, is that people are betting on the consumer. They're betting on things that have got solid dividends. They're betting on companies that have got strong cash flows. That's rather different from what they've been investing in so far this year, which has been in growth, which has been in advancing technology, in really the phenomenal pace of technological innovation. We've seen that valuations have really increased fairly considerably. Now we're getting a pause within what I would consider high momentum shares, but then it is dividend aristocrat type companies tend to be doing better. And even Walt Disney, which had been pulling back since April, has now firmed again from above that $100 area and the region of the trend mean. So when we start to put all of that together, then what we have seen is that major bull and bear markets do not unfold in straight lines, that not every sector goes up at the same time. And at the beginning of this bull market in 2010, 2030, sorry, I think beginning in around 2013, we saw a significant number of these dividend aristocrat co type companies breaking up and out of long-term ranges. And they outperformed the market for a couple of years and then entered these rather lengthy periods of ranging, and most particularly the consumer goods type companies. And now they are starting to break higher. And part of the reason for that is because for the first time in a few years, we are back in a position of synchronized global economic expansion. And periods of global economic expansion are generally positive for the consumer sector. There is an additional point though, and it is that their earnings, because they are truly international companies, their earnings are being boosted by the weakness of the dollar. The dollar has been trending lower just about all year. And it is now right at the region of the lower side of what is a 2-year range. This represents an area of support, or well, at least potential support. It is becoming increasingly overextended on the downside, and the first clear upward dynamic sustained for more than a day or two is likely to signal a low of at least near-term significance. But the underperformance of the dollar is also boosting the commodity sector, and most particularly the industrial metals. This is the LME Metals Index, and it has, and I think if we really look at it with more history, we get a better picture of what's going on, because it trended lower from 4,500 to 2,000 between 2011 and 2016, and now we are back on a recovery trajectory, and it is at a new recovery high this week. And copper prices are the, I think they're the chart that has the most influence on that index, and this was an emphatic breakout this week. So that is certainly being boosted by the weakness of the dollar, but it is also being boosted by the return to outperformance of the global economy. That what we are seeing most acutely in the news is the trouble that is happening in Venezuela, the corruption scandals that are plaguing Brazil, the fact that North Korea has launched another missile in the last 5 or 6 hours. And these are all the things that are going to be making news headlines. But out there in the wider world, things really are getting better. That when we look at the major population centers that China and I've been amazed over the last week walking around in southern China, just how much things have changed. That I wrote a piece earlier in the week about the influence of Alipay, the delivery systems that we have out there. But there has been an additional change, that customer service has got better. That's something that anyone who has been to China might really doubt. But that the review system, the fact that that people will leave reviews, and that will affect your business, has really helped to change the way that people interact. And it is quite a profound change. It's something that I really didn't think was ever possible, but customer service is definitely getting better in China. And that is part and parcel with the evolution of a domestic consumer economy. That the evolution of a consumer economy is in large part the evolution of customer service. And that's what's happening in China. And it isn't something that was really evident the last time I was here. This has been just an incredible change, and it is happening incredibly rapidly. So that's something that is, I think, really, I find quite encouraging, that we are at a point where things are happening rather quickly. That has been a big question, I think a lot of people have had, is that with the speed of markets, that is there now the possibility that cycles that once could have taken decades to unfold will unfold faster? Well, there is potential, but what I think is important to realize is that when you have a large young population like we have in India, where half the population is younger than 26 years old, that they're all going to be getting older at the same time. There is a cycle to life, and that when you have so many young people entering the workforce, entering their most productive period, then they are all going to require similar resources. And that is a massive change, that India is going to have upwards of 500 million people entering their most productive period of life within the next decade. And it is a massive change. It's something that has largely already happened in China. And China is further along in terms of its development. But when we look at the Indian stock market, it has been, I think, rallying really quite powerfully so far this year. But it is now at the region of 10,000, and 10,000 on the Nifty is a significant number. Of course, if one was looking at the Sensex, which is the other large cap index, then it is not really at a substantial round number. In fact, it has really just broken above a substantial round number at 30,000. I think one of the most important things that has happened in India over the last while has been the fact that the rupee has broken its downtrend, or that the dollar's uptrend has been broken. This is a profound change. This is something that was practically inconceivable back in 2013, when the rupee was accelerating lower. But now what we have seen is that inflation is starting to come down, and that is offering the RBI the opportunity to cut interest rates, and more abundant liquidity and lower interest rates. That really is a very positive development for the Indian economy, not just over the short term, but over the medium term. And when we think about what is it that India needs, what India needs is infrastructure. If the one thing that China lacked was the evolution of a domestic consumer economy, then it does really appear now to be well on its way to getting one. But then, if we look at India, what is the one thing that India really needs more than anything else? Because India has had the consumer economy as a vestige of the the British Raj. What it really needs is infrastructure. And the kind of infrastructure that countries need today is a little different to the kind of infrastructure that they would have needed 30 years ago. There is no doubt that a country like India needs roads, railways, ports, and airports. And it needs warehouses and factories to employ millions and millions of people. But what it also needs is a technology. And the fact that Reliance Industries has succeeded in upgrading the entire phone network from 2G to 4G, and that that has started in January of this year, that the investment period contributed to the underperformance of the share for much of the last 3 years, and that it is now at a new all-time high. That is really a testament to how powerful this change has been, that putting a smartphone in people's hands and giving them internet connectivity, that breaks down barriers to participation in the global economy. And that's a profound change. That is something that, and the very fact that you do not necessarily need to be literate to have a smartphone or to use a smartphone is really quite a something that was previously impossible. India has not done a particularly good job of educating its vast numbers of people, and that is something that will have to change over time. But you have to first allow people to participate in the economy if they're going to better their lives. And the introduction of 4G is something that is a massive game changer for the Indian economy. So then, if we look at what is in fact happening out there, that you have the two largest population countries in the world where you are getting real change. And in many respects, I think the Chinese stock market is, I think, state-sponsored. It's probably the best way to think about it. The A-share index has been doing really nothing at all for much of the last 2 years. That there was a massive advance in 2014 and 2015 with the confluence of the Hong Kong Shanghai Stock Connect and the introduction of options to the market, and the considering that it is the domestic investor has a very large weighting in the A share index that contributed to a bubbly environment. And the administration does not want to see that again, and most particularly they don't want to see that again before the party congress in September or October. That is also part of the reason that we're seeing China being more, I think, assertive or aggressive on the Indian border, while they are also unlikely to want to do anything, I think, really constructive with North Korea before September or October. But after that, I think that there is the potential for things to get better. In the meantime, they certainly don't want the embarrassment of a stock market that is pulling back, considering that you can no longer access pictures of Winnie the Pooh. That's a comparatively small thing relative to what we can see on the stock market, that money is where people's mouths are. And the fact is that the H-share index has been trending higher for 18 months already, and doing so in a reasonably consistent manner. So I think that there is also the point here that we have there has been a change to the way that the renminbi is trading as well, because the renminbi trended lower in a pretty consistent manner from really from the middle of 2015. And what this chart says to me, at least, is that the trend of the renminbi trending lower is over. And this is now the dollar holding a progression of lower rally highs against the renminbi. It's down to 6.75, and I think it would be a sustained move above 6.8 would be required to really question that this isn't going to continue to to trend lower. The Chinese had to stabilize their currency. There was increasing questions about their commitment to the stability of the currency, and it was creating some I think doubts about what the intentions of the administration were. And I think that that is now over. That at least until September or October, we can anticipate that the renminbi will continue to strengthen. That every effort is being made to make sure that this event goes off really very smoothly, because it is a once in a generation opportunity for the people at the top of the Communist Party to cement their power beyond their own holding of office. That there are so many vacant spots on the Standing Committee and the Politburo that need to be filled, and there is an enormous competition going on to ensure that the people who fill those spots are friendly to the current administration. That would ensure that Xi Jinping would have the kind of influence that Jiang Zemin has had when he leaves office, and it would cement his legacy in terms of what he has been trying to achieve. And those from a politician's perspective, the stakes couldn't be higher. And that's I think a very important characteristic to what we have in this market over the next 3 or 4 months. But over the medium to longer term, the fact that China is succeeding in developing a consumer economy, that's a that really is a wonderful success. And the challenge remains, of course, that there are bad loans, and that what they term themselves as grey rhinos, these large companies that have got a lot of debt and not a great plan for how to pay it back. And that is certainly a risk. There, it's not as if this is a Pollyannaish view of what is out there, what are the challenges that China faces. But so far, they have been able to meet those challenges, and there are proactive steps going on to change some of the structural issues that the country has, and that's also the case for India. And if we go back and then look at some of the developed markets, that when we look at what's happening in Europe, the euro has been strengthening pretty impressively, and if we look at, for example, the German 10-year bond yield, well, it was in negative territory as recently as last year. And now we've seen that yields have started to move back up again. And what that suggests is that there is less need for the ECB to be so active in help in trying to support the market. That Europe is heading towards greater cohesion, and the UK has decided that they don't want to be a part of that. The fact that this week Greece has been able to come back to the market is a big deal for that country, and but it also helps to highlight the fact that Greece, despite all of the problems that it has had, is still within the European fold. That the thing that has been out there on the horizon has been debt forgiveness, and it is absolutely impossible before the German election. But at the same time, what has been promised to them is that there will be some form of debt forgiveness after the German election. The weakness that Europe has is that it is subject to individual country mandates and the individual election cycle of European countries, and that politics tends to come ahead of what might necessarily be better for the European populace. Quite whether one wants to be a part of a European or a United States of Europe that isn't particularly democratic, or that doesn't have the democratic institutions that people might want, is another story entirely. But what we can also say is that it is happening. and that there isn't any great, I think, political movement to derail it, and most particularly in France and Germany. And as long as that remains the case, then the potential is that Europe will continue to coalesce, and that this is a long-term project. And the Euro Stoxx index has been a serial underperformer. The FTSE 100 has already broken out, the Wall Street has already broken out, India's at new highs. And then when we look at Europe, it has been in the doldrums for much of the last 17 years, and it is really still a fair bit below its previous peak. We have seen it consolidating over the last 6 weeks, and I think that that is simply a consolidation following a very powerful period. I think it is looking increasingly likely that the Euro Stoxx index is going to be able to break out. And when we look at the Europe 600, this is much closer to its peak. It's a similar process of mean reversion is going on right now, but I think it is looking increasingly likely that it will be breaking up and out of this range over the medium term, and that Europe will be able to participate in this really rather bullish period for stock markets. The FTSE 100 was able to break up and out of its long-term range earlier this year, but and these are very long-term ranges, but these long-term ranges pale in comparison to the long-term ranges that we have in Asia. The Taiwanese market has been, and I have to go out to 50 years for this, has been ranging below 10,000 since 1991. And that's a very long range that has just been completed. And the TOPIX index has been ranging below 1,750 since 1991 as well. And it is pushing back up towards to the upper side of this long-term range. I think this is and I've mentioned it previously, but this is a profound change that we've seen in just the last few years. Every time that the TOPIX has got up to 1,750 in the last 26 years, it has moved to a new low. And it didn't do that in 2015. It posted a higher reaction low for the first time in a long, long time. And that is a change that suggests that there is a change in the imbalance between supply and demand, and that a move above 1,750 for the TOPIX would confirm a return to medium-term demand dominance and potentially the beginning of a new secular bull market in Japan. And that is practically an anathema statement to anyone who has been punished by the secular bear market in Japan, which has crushed hopes on successive occasions for decades. When we start thinking about this in the broad spectrum of where are we in terms of the market cycle, that there are some important charts. This is the yield curve spread, and it has been contracting from really attractive levels since about 2011, and it is now down to less than 100 basis points. But that is still a fair amount away from zero, and it is below zero that we get lead indicators for future recessions. And the fact that it is trending lower, certainly, but that we are still well above zero suggests that we are not going to have a recession this year, and that depending on how this trend evolves, we may not have one next year either. That's, I think, a very important fact. Then, if we look at the Dow Gold ratio, then we have, I think, one of the most useful pictures of any market. It's this incredibly lengthy period of outperformance of stocks versus commodities and commodities versus stocks. And we have had this, I think there are three really important points that we can highlight on this chart. The first is that each high is successively higher, that every bull market that we have had has seen stocks outperform gold by more. And that would suggest that the next time this goes to an all-time new high, it's going to be above, or excuse me, of course it's going to be above 40 if it's an all-time new high, but that's what we can anticipate, that the next high could be somewhere around 45. Then there is this consistency in the distance or in the time between the peaks, and it is somewhere in the region of about 33 or 34 years. If the last peak was in 1999, it means that the next peak is going to be somewhere around 2032 or 2033. If that's indeed the case, and this ratio has gone from 7 to about 17 and could yet go to 45, it means that the Dow Jones will trade at over 45 times the price of gold. And that is a simple measure of how much stocks could go up from here. Because the Dow Jones is currently trading at 21,000, almost 22,000, and that is 17 times the price of gold. If gold does nothing at all, then the potential is that the Dow will trade around 50,000 at some point in the early 2030s. And that's for a small number of companies. It would suggest that there are going to be other companies do substantially better than that. Then that we are in a secular bull market. And secular bull markets can go on for longer than most people can really consider. That we tend to worry about the short term. We tend to worry about what the potential is in the very short term. What is the market going to do in the next 6 weeks? But rather, we should really be thinking about the longer term. That if it is going to be 2 years before we get a recession, that the potential is that this cyclical bull market, which has been going on since 2009, could do much better. That we could move into an acceleration. And in fact, if we think about this very logically, that central banks are bubble blowers, that their response to a crash is to massively increase the supply of money. And that arrests the decline in asset prices in one sector, and it starts to boost asset prices in another. And certainly we have seen a great deal of monetary accommodation, and there has been a large amount of asset price inflation, and most particularly in stocks and real estate. And when that eventually ends, it is going to contribute to a medium-term correction, and that there are going to be some sectors that are wiped away. But if this is a secular bull market, then that punctuating mark is going to be a phenomenal buying opportunity. And that punctuating mark may not be may be somewhere out there, you know, 3 years from now, at which point prices could be substantially above where they are today. So we have to go back and just ask ourselves the simple question again. Is there any evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend-ending characteristics? Because if the answer is no, we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And that is despite the fact that there's a rotation going on, that obviously then the weight should be given towards what people are rotating into. The fact that commodities are doing better, the fact that technology is doing better, and that banks are doing better, these are all cyclical shares and are cyclical sectors. Then the fact that it is the old world, the consumer goods, fast-moving consumer goods, consumer staples, consumer discretionary are doing better. That's also a bet on the rise of the global consumer, and I think we have increasing evidence that that is contributing to synchronized global economic expansion. So I think that there is ample opportunity out there. I think that, but the most important point is that the general trend is upwards, and that this is we are in a secular bull market. within a secular bull market, then the most likely scenario is that prices go up. That doesn't mean that there won't be challenges. That doesn't mean that there won't be things to be worried about. And certainly there are plenty of things to be worried about. And the quantity of liquidity that has been pumped into the system is definitely something to worry about. We've never been in this situation before, and it is going to create an ugly problem at some point in the future. I think the most important thing about bond markets is that servicing the debt is rarely becomes the problem. It is when debt needs to be refinanced is when you then get into trouble, because you may not be able to refinance at the rate you were originally able to take the debt out at. Then your servicing costs rise, and that's the point at which both companies and countries get into trouble. And there is a great deal of debt needs to be refinanced in that window between 2019 and 2021. If we were thinking about when there might be a recession, then it's got to be somewhere out there where there's going to be a lot of debt needs to be refinanced. So that could contribute to a bear market. But of course, the most important point is that in a secular bull market, there will occasionally be bear markets, and there will occasionally be recessions. And the most important point is that it is different in that these recessions do not derail the secular bull market. That's the real hallmark of a secular bull, that within a secular bear market contraction, or a generational-long process of P/E ratio contraction and rising dividend yields, that we could get these big crashes that hold up the market for decades. And that's what happened. We had a crash in 2000, and we had another crash in 2008. And in a secular bear market for stocks, that contributed to volatile, lengthy ranging. In a secular bull market for stocks, the medium-term corrections, when they occur, do not turn into these types of massive crashes. And that is something that is perhaps the hallmark of the secular bull. But that doesn't mean that markets can't pull back by 20 and 30%, and that some sectors will crash, that you can get a significant rotation out of high-performing sectors and into less well-performing sectors, and that is the natural progress of any market move, that some sectors will do better than others at different times. Something that also I have been considering over the last week has been the role of cash in the economy, because there has been a great deal of commentary about what went on in India and the demonetization, where they took the 100 rupee note out of circulation and replaced it. And part of the reason for that was because there was so much fake currency in the economy that they wanted to bring more people into the tax network. So they wanted people to open bank accounts and not rely overly on cash. And that received a great deal of publicity. But what has been going on in China over the same period has received absolutely no commentary at all. That I've got pictures on my phone from billboards by Alipay saying this is going to be the week without cash, and that if by using Alipay you're going to get rewarded, and that U.S. investors will be, or and Australian or UK investors will be, or consumers will be familiar with using a credit card and getting rewards. But with using Alipay to pay, you get money off your bill, and the savings are instantaneous. When you use Alipay to save your money, you're getting paid your interest on a daily basis. So then that is also contributing to people wanting to keep their money online and not in cash. And what it is contributing to is that there is an increasing number of shops that you cannot pay with cash. That there is that before midday, where you might be able to go to an ATM, that the ATM may not have any cash, And what that's contributing to is the introduction of a cashless society, not just in small terms, but in very, very large terms. And what that is also contributing to is greater control for governments. And monetary purists are going to be appalled at that evolution, that we're already moving towards a cashless society in the West, but it has been much slower, that the evolution of the cashless society in Asia is approaching at breakneck speeds. And I think it is that perhaps we should be taking the Chinese seriously when they talk about that creating a social scoring network by putting cameras everywhere and then monitoring people and using facial recognition software. It sounds rather far-fetched, but I don't think it is beyond the realm of the Chinese administration to try. And when we look at Bitcoin, it has been the asset that has done probably best so far this year. There have been a number of changes that have occurred in the last week that are potentially noteworthy. But what it is to many people, not least the people that own it, and I think it is something that a lot of conventional commentators don't seem to get, is that it represents a store of value for the modern generation. That there are a lot of people of a somewhat older vintage have the view that gold is a real store of value because you can hold it, that it has a tactile quality, that it is a real asset, that it is nobody's debt, and that these are some of the and of course then there is there are a good many people, they want to hold these kinds of assets because they don't trust governments. They don't trust the way that governments use the currency or debase currency for their own uses. And the evolution of a cashless society is only going to increase the power of governments to be able to debase the currency. And that's the reason that people own gold. And that is the reason that people own Bitcoin in many respects. They want to own it as a store of value. That and their logic is reasonable in that obviously the value of Bitcoin is only what someone else is willing to give you for it, and that is also the case with hard assets like gold. That its value, in many respects, is only in what someone else is willing to give you for it. The logic or the argument that is being used to support Bitcoin is that we are a data-driven society. We're no longer heavily influenced by the extractive resources sector, and therefore our store of value should be within the data-driven economy, and the cryptocurrencies fit that bill. The two things that have happened this week that are really important and worth considering is that the CFTC has approved options trading in Bitcoin and potentially in Ethereum later on, and the introduction of leverage into a market that has previously been largely unleveraged could potentially be a profound change. This has already been incredibly volatile, but the introduction of leverage could contribute to even more volatility, and that's likely to happen in the next few months. And there was also a piece of news this week that it is looking increasingly likely that Bitcoin miners are coalescing around the idea of allowing the absolute number of Bitcoins potentially mined to increase, which would help to streamline the system. It would help to speed up transactions, and it will allow Bitcoin to be a more useful strategy for smart contracts. What we can certainly see from the chart is that it accelerated to 3,000, pulled back violently to 2,000, and we are now in a range. And this is not the first time it has ranged, and it's not going to be the last time it ranges. But a sustained move below the trend mean would be required to question the medium-term upward bias. And gold prices, and perhaps there is an argument that the massive advance that we've had in Bitcoin has sapped some interest from the precious metals this year. But gold prices have been steadying from the $1,200 area. They are back above the trend mean. To me, to my eyes at least, this continues to look like a period of right-hand extension following the massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend at the beginning of 2016. And as long as it is holding the $1,200 area, we can probably give the benefit of the doubt to the upside that that gold still has some attraction from the perspective of investors, that it can continue to offer a non-correlated status versus what's happening in either bonds or equities, and that it does have the potential to appreciate from here, but that it is unlikely that we are now in a secular bull market for gold, that the secular bull market for gold ended in 2011, that it is likely to underperform stocks for the foreseeable lengthy medium term, and that would suggest that we are going to have cyclical bull markets in precious metals, but that it could be another 20 years before we have a secular bull market in precious metals. And that is also worth considering with regard to oil prices. We have been through a very lengthy period of. Hold on, me just get into the place where I can type. We've had a very lengthy period where oil prices were high. And the oldest adage from the commodity markets is that the cure for high prices is high prices. And when you have trillions of dollars invested in new supply, well, then we have to expect that that new supply will eventually come to market. And we have had that beginning over the last couple of weeks. Let me just update that chart to yesterday. So oil prices collapsed in 2016 or 2014, 2015. They've been ranging since, and but ranging below $60 and ranging above $40. If we look back over the bear market period all the way from 1990, that $40 was a It was a resistance level for much of that period, and now it represents an area of support. It's another wonderful example of where past resistance becomes future support. But the bigger question is, how successfully can oil prices sustain a move above 60? That's a much bigger question, and there is a great deal of additional supply becomes economic above $60. So we have this year been through a very choppy, rangy environment for oil prices, and right now the impetus is on the upside, and the potential is that we get back up towards the upper side of this range, but then we run back into the problem that there is a great deal of additional supply becomes economic at $60, and then demand growth would have to improve substantially to sap up the amount of available supply that is out there. Or we would have to have an additional move by OPEC to take supply out of the market and to rebalance the supply demand imbalances. So, or I guess the to flip the supply demand imbalance. And that's not beyond the bounds of possibility. Generally speaking, better global economic growth is positive for energy prices. But we have been through a secular period of massive investment in additional supply, and now that supply is in the market, and it represents a game changer for the index. a game changer for the energy complex generally. That would suggest that this is going to be a choppy, rangy environment for the foreseeable future. That occasionally we will have periods where oil prices surge higher, but that they will not be sustained. That's emblematic of a secular bull market, excuse me, secular bear market in energy prices. And that removes a headwind from global economic growth. It's a contributing factor to the rise of the global consumer. And that's likely to be. And I think right now what we have is commodity prices doing better because we're in the latter stages of a cyclical advance. These are cyclical sectors, and they are coming off very depressed levels so that they can do better in the latter stages of a cyclical advance. But that this is not a secular advance. That for the secular advance, we need to look at technology, need to look at biotechnology, and we need to look at the consumer. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.